to mental habits as well as to physical habits. Advertising men have learned that the repetition of ideas is an essential for successful advertisements. Millions of dollars are spent annually for the sole purpose of emphasizing the names of products by repetition. If the principle of repetition is sound in advertising, it is sound in other connections. Some men never hear what is said the first time an idea is mentioned. If it is repeated, they may think they heard some sort of noise, but they will not be certain what it meant. If it is repeated again, they will catch a vague notion of what was said. If it is repeated a fourth time, they may hear clearly what was said but not be impressed by it. Perhaps by the time the idea is repeated a fifth time, it may sink into their consciousness, but it will not remain there unless it is repeated many times thereafter. I'm speaking, of course, of new ideas. People take to new ideas slowly, and they usually show antagonism to new ideas when they first hear them. Only the trained, self-disciplined, alert mind is capable of accepting a new idea when it is first introduced. This type of mind is scarce. Remember what I have said when you wish to get a new idea across.
I can think of three words, Mr. Carnegie, which are heard and understood the first time they are spoken. They are the three little words that men sometimes speak to women. I love you.
Yes, but the idea back of them is not new. It is as old as the human race. Even these words need to be repeated often, or they lose their meaning. If you doubt it, observe the man who has stopped telling his wife or his sweetheart that he loves her. Perhaps the spirit of romance provides more enthusiasm than any other subject in the world, but it withers and dies unless it is kept alive by the repetition of words and deeds. The same may be said of the spirit of friendship. The man who neglects to proclaim his feeling of friendship by words and deeds soon finds himself without friends. You see, not even the great spirit of friendship can live without action to support it.
That is only another way of saying that everything has its price, and nothing can be gained that is of permanent value unless the price is paid.
Nothing, not even love or friendship. The man who believes that either of these important human relationships is free deceives himself. In fact, there is no other relationship which requires as careful nursing as these. The moment one stops feeding them with words and deeds, they die.
I had no intention of diverting your analysis of enthusiasm to discussion of love.
Man alive, you haven't. You have brought up a subject which inspires more enthusiasm than anything I could mention. Take enthusiasm out of love and friendship, and you have nothing left. These are among the highest forms of inspired feeling.
One might carry the illustration a step further by saying, take love and friendship out of the world, and you would have nothing left worth fighting for.
Yes, those relationships are associated with the highest achievements of civilization. If a man had no friends and loved no one, he might as well go back to the primitive state and join the beasts of the jungle.
I never thought of enthusiasm as being an essential part of one's aesthetic nature, but I can see that it is.
Not merely a part of it, but practically the whole of it. Man's capacity to enjoy or to create artistic things is, of itself, a form of enthusiasm. You will see that it is if you remember that enthusiasm is nothing but a highly concentrated form of feeling. Therefore, it is directly related to all the positive emotions.
Then enthusiasm is the action feature of the mind, which inspires all constructive effort and gives action to all positive motives.
Now you're beginning to comprehend what I have been trying to convey to you. Now you recognize why Emerson said, "Nothing great was ever achieved without enthusiasm." His statement was founded on a deep understanding of the power of enthusiasm, for he must have known that it is the action feature of all positive thoughts and all constructive effort.
Yes, I understand now why you emphasized the necessity of one's adopting an obsessional motive as the foundation of one's definite major purpose in life. An obsessional motive is one behind which has been placed the feeling of enthusiasm. Is that it?
You understand it correctly. Take care that you understand also that enthusiasm can be developed, like any other habit, by the control of one's mental and physical habits.
Your analysis has given me the answer to a question that has puzzled me for a long while. I have observed that the average public speaker has to go through what he calls the warming-up period during the first few minutes of his speech before he shows signs of enthusiasm. From what you have said about the relationship between enthusiasm and action, I draw the conclusion that the warming-up process consists of the coordination of thought with the physical expression of words. That thought is intensified until it becomes enthusiasm through physical expression.
Well, that's a new idea to me, but I have the feeling you are right. There is another factor in connection with public speaking which had never occurred to me before. I've observed that the greatest brilliancy of thought is attained by the public speaker when his enthusiasm is at its highest pitch. Therefore, it is obvious that enthusiasm stimulates the imagination, makes one's memory more alert, and perhaps gives the public speaker direct connection with infinite intelligence through the subconscious section of the mind under certain conditions when his enthusiasm is at a high pitch. I had long ago observed that the subconscious mind acts more quickly on ideas that are created under highly emotional conditions.
Your analysis suggests the idea that the state of mind known as faith is directly related to the emotional feeling of enthusiasm.
Yes, it does. Intense enthusiasm probably steps up the rate of thought vibrations so that the conscious mind may connect directly with infinite intelligence. If this theory is correct, it would account for the fact that prayer sometimes brings the desired results, while at other times it brings no results at all. It seems to be the consensus of opinion of all to whom I have talked about prayer that it never produces desired results unless it is accompanied by faith. We have reason to believe that the emotional feeling of enthusiasm clears the mind of thought impulses which prevent faith. Now let me call your attention to the fact that this theory, if it is no more than a theory, applies also to circumstances other than prayer. For example, when one adopts the habit of definiteness of purpose and applies it in connection with all of his daily routine, he very soon reaches the point at which he expects the object of his desires to be attained. By concentrating his thoughts upon his desires, he is usually rewarded in due time by faith in his ability to get what he desires. Now, the important feature I wish you to observe is the fact that ordinary desire becomes absolute faith in proportion that one intensifies his desire by his enthusiasm. When enthusiasm becomes so great that it enables one to have enough faith to see, in his imagination, the object of his desires already in his possession, even before he actually has obtained physical possession, he experiences precisely the same results that he would obtain if he called his desires prayer. The name one gives to this mysterious power is unimportant. It brings results under one name as well as under any other. The state of mind in which one approaches the subject is the really important thing. Fear, doubt, indefiniteness, and lack of enthusiasm produce negative results, always, in connection with the principle of desire. If the mind is dominated by any one of these negatives, the results of desire will be negative. On this point, I can be definite, for I have made a lifetime study of the subject in connection with my own experiences and the experiences of many others. It is impressively significant that the lack of enthusiasm ends in negative results in connection with both the principle of definiteness of purpose and the more formal expression of desires known as prayer.
Then the person who is incapable of developing enthusiasm is hopelessly handicapped, is he not?
No. I wouldn't state it that strongly. The word hopeless is very final. It is almost as final as the word death. I do not like to think of any circumstance as hopeless beyond cure. The person who cannot or will not develop enthusiasm may still find hope in the mastermind principle, through which he may obtain the benefits of minds that can develop enthusiasm. He may also avail himself of the aid of doctors of suggestive therapeutics, in extreme cases of melancholy and hypochondria, imaginary illness, and gain relief from the condition which prevents the free flow of thought that is necessary in developing enthusiasm. It has been discovered that ill temper, negative mental attitude, indifference, laziness, and the lack of alertness of the mind in general often are the result of some physical condition which can be corrected. These conditions are also traceable, oftentimes, to some quirk in the mental equipment of the brain, which can be corrected by suggestive therapeutics, a mild application of hypnotism, and by autosuggestion applied by the individual, provided he understands the operations of the mind and has a will to correct evils that prevent its normal operations.
It appears that enthusiasm and sound health have much in common.
Yes, you might go further and say that whenever one is lacking in enthusiasm, it should be a sign for him to look after his physical health, for there is where he will find the cause. People of normal health, physical and mental health, seldom are lacking in enthusiasm. An alert mind cannot function in a dull, sluggish body.
What about the habit of drinking alcoholic beverages? Is that not one of the destroyers of enthusiasm?
The habit does more than destroy enthusiasm. First, it inspires greater enthusiasm, but the reaction known as the morning after is the real destroyer. The physical body manufactures its own alcohol in such quantities as it needs. Beyond this amount, any alcohol that is taken into the body may become a poison that breaks down bodily resistance. The only safe stimulant of the physical body, outside of the stimulants supplied by physicians in medical treatment, is mental stimulation through inspiration and enthusiasm. That sort of stimulation has no detrimental physical reactions. It is nature's medicine. If it becomes a habit, it is a beneficial habit, which is more than can be said of any artificial stimulant, such as drugs or alcohol.
Then you condemn the use of narcotics and alcohol?
Absolutely, unless they are administered under the direction of a reputable physician who uses them for medicinal purposes in treating people who are ill.
You wouldn't recommend even a social drink?
Social drinks might do no harm if they are taken in moderation, but too many people begin the alcohol habit by an occasional social drink. It is safe to remain a teetotaler.
I have heard that some very great authors, musicians, and poets did their best work under the influence of alcohol, such men as Edgar Allan Poe, Robert Burns, James Whitcomb Riley, and Stephen Foster.
Yes, perhaps they did good work under the influence of liquor, but do not overlook the tragedy of their lives. We know of a part of that tragedy, but not all of it. Liquor and sound minds do not harmonize. Intoxicating liquor will stimulate the action of the brain, but the reaction will be the equivalent of the action. It will consist of headaches and dulled faculties of the mind. If this sort of mind stimulation becomes a habit, it will destroy the capacity for inspired feeling, which is nature's method of stimulating the mind with a natural energy that leaves no unfavorable effects. One may become highly intoxicated with enthusiasm, but that sort of intoxication leaves no headaches behind it, nor does it destroy the capacity of the brain to respond to the stimuli that inspire enthusiasm.
It seems, then, that when man substitutes his method of stimulating the brain for that already provided by nature, he pays a penalty for his mistake by having nature's method withheld from him. Is that what you mean?
That's it. Nature penalizes interference with her methods of functioning, not only in the matter of mind stimulation, but in all other respects. For example, nature provides a covering of hair for protection of the head. But if a man tries to improve her handiwork by supplementing it with a covering of his own, consisting of a tight-fitting hat that cuts off the circulation of the blood from the roots of the hair, nature penalizes the interference with baldness. Nature does precisely the same thing when man substitutes his own methods of brain stimulation by the use of alcohol and narcotics. But in this case, she looks with particular disfavor on man's efforts, because she not only penalizes him with headaches and toxic poisoning, but she fastens habits upon him which blind him by his own folly. If you have ever known intimately a person who was suffering from the habit of alcoholism or narcotics, you recognize what a terrible punishment nature visits upon the individual who substitutes artificial stimulants for nature's method of stimulating the brain. Finally, if the habit is continued, nature takes the supreme toll for violation of her laws by causing illness or even death. Thus it seems obvious that the brain is one part of the physical body that cannot be interfered with without penalties which no one can afford to pay.
Yes, I understand what you mean. Moreover, your analysis has given me an entirely new and better understanding of the nature of the damage one does himself when he stimulates his brain through negative thoughts. I could see that nature penalizes one for his lack of faith by fastening on him his habits of unbelief.
And the same principle applies to one's mental attitude, no matter what its nature may be. If it is positive, nature rewards one with the benefits of a positive mind by the law of habit, through which the benefits may become permanent. If the mental attitude is negative, nature penalizes one for his mistake through that same law of habit.
Then nature appears not to overlook anything a man thinks or does?
No, not even a single thought. Every thought one releases and every physical act in which he engages becomes a part of his own character.
Obviously, then, the man whose dominating thoughts are negative reaches the point, eventually, at which most of his physical action is negative?
That is the way nature works. And that accounts for the fact that there are so many people who have no capacity for enthusiasm. They have destroyed their capacity for mind stimulation through natural media of stimuli. Many such people turn to liquor and narcotics, vainly believing these artificial stimulants will benefit them. The truth is that such stimulants serve only the purpose of fastening the penalty upon them more firmly. The man who tries to escape fear, worry, or sorrow by the use of artificial stimulants meets with precisely the same experience as the man who tries to get out of quicksand by trying to pull himself out. Each effort sinks him a little deeper.
I never imagined that liquor had anything to do with indifference and the lack of enthusiasm, but I can see from your analysis that it has.
If you will study any person who is just recovering from the effects of liquor, you will know that he has been damaged, not benefited. The distorted expression on his face, his red, blurred eyes, his ill temper, his dull imagination, his nervousness, his upset stomach and loss of appetite, all tell a story that cannot be ignored. On the other hand, observe any person whose brain has been stimulated by obsessional desire or enthusiasm or any other form of inspiration, and take note of the condition of his mind. Here you will find calmness, poise, sparkling eyes, musical tone of voice, softened lines in the face, and general alertness of the mind. Such observations can have no other effect than that of convincing one that nature penalizes all methods of mind stimulation except those associated with inspired feeling. There simply is no escape from this conclusion.
Yes, I have made such observations, Mr. Carnegie, and I have noticed that your illustration applies to the man who stimulates his mind with anger, fear, revenge, jealousy, or any other negative emotion. The same as to the person who uses alcohol.
That is precisely correct. And I wish to call your attention to the fact that all these habits, whether positive or negative, leave their marks of identification indelibly fixed on the features of the face and in the tone of the voice. That is another way nature has of rewarding or penalizing one for the use he makes of his prerogative power of thought. She clearly paints a picture of one's mental habits on one's face, so the whole world may be warned of a man's nature. Glassy eyes, harsh, irritable tones of the voice, hard lines in the face, snarly curve of the lips, nervous movements of the body all combine to inform the world that an individual is not at peace within his own mind.
Your analysis gives me the thought that it might pay one handsomely to look himself over very carefully in a mirror, to make sure that he is not deceiving himself as to his own mental attitude.
That would be an excellent plan if a man would learn to read the signs I have mentioned. But there is another signal by which a man may get an accurate clue as to the real nature of his mental attitude. It is his own inner feeling. Enthusiasm, hope, and self-reliance are the natural assets of a self-disciplined person. Where these states of mind are lacking, there is something that needs investigation. There is never an exception to this rule. The man who is at peace with himself and with the world never goes to bed without some degree of hope associated with the unborn tomorrow. On this point, every person should test himself every day. Where hope is missing, something has taken its place that needs to be removed. It is obvious that nature has provided every person with an accurate means of self-analysis in this simple test, which discloses hope or the lack of it.
I had never thought of hope in that manner, Mr. Carnegie. Now that you have mentioned it, I can recall from my own limited experience that you are right. Your revelation gives me a better understanding also of the principle of definiteness of purpose. If one has a definite major purpose, it serves to provide him with the means of testing himself on a great many qualities, such as self-reliance, initiative, imagination, self-discipline, creative vision, organized thought, and many other essential qualities. Anytime a man finds himself without hope for the attainment of his definite major purpose, it should serve as a warning to him that some necessary trait of mind is missing. Some damaging habit has begun to take hold on him. Is that the idea?
You stated it perfectly. Hope is the forerunner of faith. Where there is no hope, there can be no faith. You can be sure that where there is no enthusiasm, there is no hope, for the two are closely related. As a matter of fact, enthusiasm is a definite expression of hope. First comes hope, which is the result of desire, then follows an expression of hope through enthusiasm. Those ripen into faith, the state of mind that masters all forms of defeat and overcomes all obstacles standing between one and the attainment of his definite major purpose, or his minor purposes which lead to the attainment of his major purpose. You see, therefore, that hope, enthusiasm, and faith are key words with a stupendous meaning because of their close relationship with one another and the circumstances of life which we call success. Where one of these is missing, success is not possible.
That is the equivalent of saying that success requires enthusiasm?
Exactly. Success narrows itself down to the question of one's state of mind, and we have seen clearly, I hope, that no state of mind is more important than enthusiasm. Obsessional desire and enthusiasm are synonymous terms. When one speaks of a burning desire, he means a desire that is backed by enthusiasm. We know that this is the sort of desire that inspires creative vision, personal initiative, self-reliance, definiteness of purpose, and all the other qualities that are indispensable for successful achievement.
I never knew before that enthusiasm had so many relatives. Why, it seems to be related to all the positive qualities of the mind.
Yes, and you might have observed also that it is a powerful deterrent to all the negative qualities of the mind. It serves, therefore, not only as a mind stimulant, but also helps to police the mind against the intrusion of negative habits.
This explains, then, why a hearty laugh a day keeps the old man blues away. I also recall that most people who smile when they speak usually speak only of things that are constructive.
You might carry your observations a little further and discover that people who smile habitually, even when they are not speaking, thereby announce to the world that their dominating thoughts are positive. By carrying your observation still further, you will learn the coordination between mental attitude and physical action, when one smiles, produces a desirable change in the working of the brain. The theory I am here analyzing explains also why forced physical exercise, such as one gets in the gymnasium, does less good than exercise one gets when playing a game in which he takes a keen interest, where there is coordination between mind and body.
Your explanation reminds me that motive is an important factor in everything one does. I recall now that the exercise my father forced me to take as a means of punishment for misconduct involved no more labor than was required when I went on a fishing trip, but the effects were vastly different.
Of course, the forced labor had no enthusiasm back of it. The fishing trip did have. There was coordination of body and mind on the fishing trip, but none in connection with the forced labor. And I suspect that you could have done 10 times as much physical labor on the fishing trip as you did in the performance of the forced labor, with less feeling of fatigue. Any physical action one takes in a spirit of enthusiasm requires less energy than the same action would require if the enthusiasm were not present.
You mean, of course, that one's mental attitude modifies the physical energy one uses in all forms of physical movement?
Yes, and you need not go any further than to analyze the difference in the energy one uses in work and in play, to recognize that mental attitude is a very important factor in the loss or the preservation of physical energy. Enthusiasm takes the drudgery out of labor, no matter what one may be doing. For this reason, everyone should devote some time daily to recreation through some sort of action in which he takes a keen interest. That old saying that all work and no play makes Jack a dull boy is no mere figure of speech. It is based on sound psychology.
But what of the man who likes his work better than any sort of play? Does it not serve as recreation for him?
Yes, to a certain extent it does. But everyone should have a change of both his mental habits and his physical action if he desires to maintain sound health. A man should learn to play as vigorously as he works. Moreover, he should learn to switch his entire mind from work to play. This is a form of self-discipline that is required for sound health. I have known men who took their work to bed with them at night, but most of them did not live the average span of years. Here is one of the circumstances which call for sufficient self-discipline to enable one to switch his motives from work to play without the loss of enthusiasm. The physical body requires variety in both thought and physical action, the same as it requires variety of food. The man who lives on one plane and works under one set of conditions always comes finally to be what we call eccentric. He loses his sense of proportion, and with it, much of his self-discipline. A man should be so flexible that he can change from one mental attitude to another and switch from one sort of physical action to another at will without losing his poise. In this manner only can one break the daily rhythm of his routine and escape fixed habits by which he would otherwise be bound. For many years, I have made it a part of my daily routine to switch my mind from my major purpose to some totally disassociated purpose. Sometimes I play golf. At other times I listen to music, preferably a symphony. At other times I read. But always I find time at least once every working day to put aside all thoughts that are related to my major purpose in life. I find that by doing this, my mind is fresh and alert when it comes back to the major purpose. Therefore, it is more efficient. about the saddest creature on the earth is the child who, because of economic pressure or otherwise, is reared without the privilege of playing. The damaging effects of that sort of life will go with a child all through life. The human being is so created that he requires continuous change of habits in order to maintain sound health and remain happy. It is the natural response to this part of man's nature which causes everyone to like to travel. Travel brings change of thoughts, gives one mental rest.
This analysis has carried me into pretty deep water, Mr. Carnegie, but I must confess that it has given me a much better understanding of the part enthusiasm plays in one's life. Above all, it has shown me that sustained enthusiasm calls for variation of thought and physical action. Also, that the monotony of routine can destroy the capacity for enthusiasm. So, when I play in the future, I will play with a beneficial purpose in mind.
That's precisely the point I wish you to understand. Everything one does should be done with a definiteness of purpose, because this adds enthusiasm to one's efforts. Only in this way can enthusiasm become a habit, as it obviously does when one mixes it with both his work and his play.
You believe, then, that enthusiasm without plan or purpose back of it is useless?
Not only useless, but it may be very dangerous. Enthusiasm should be under the strict control of self-discipline, the same as any other emotion.
You believe that the self-discipline should consist in voluntary habits appropriate for the development and control of enthusiasm?
Yes. Habit is the only method of self-discipline one can control.
Analysis of Chapter 2 by Napoleon Hill. Enthusiasm is one of man's greatest assets. It beats money and power and influence. Single-handed, the enthusiast convinces and dominates, where the wealth accumulated by a small army of workers would scarcely raise a tremor of interest. Enthusiasm tramples over prejudice and opposition, spurns inaction, storms the citadel of its object, and like an avalanche overwhelms and engulfs all obstacles. It is nothing more or less than faith in action. Faith and initiative rightly combined remove mountainous barriers and achieve the unheard of and miraculous. Set the germ of enthusiasm afloat in your plant, in your office, or on your farm. Carry it in your attitude and manner. It spreads and influences every fiber of your industry before you realize it. It means increase in production and decrease in costs. It means joy and pleasure and satisfaction to your workers. It means life, real, virile. It means spontaneous bedrock results, the vital things that pay dividends throughout life. Henry Chester. One cannot read Mr. Carnegie's analysis of the importance of enthusiasm without recognizing that it is a vital energy that is related to all creative effort. The analysis convinces one, too, that enthusiasm is something vastly greater than mere optimism or hopeful wishing or daydreaming. Make a cross-section analysis of any number of people you choose. Study the circumstances of their daily lives carefully. And you will find that those who have developed a high degree of enthusiasm enjoy more of the breaks of life than do those who have little or no enthusiasm. But what is the secret behind this strange fact? Why does enthusiasm attract favorable opportunities, remove opposition, and create harmonious human relationships wherever it touches? I shall endeavor to give the answer. Every philosopher and every thinker has discovered that enthusiasm gives added meaning to words and changes the meaning of deeds, and some have discovered that it gives greater power to thought as well as to the spoken word. "I have heard an experienced counselor say," remarked Emerson, "that he feared never the effect upon a jury of a lawyer who does not believe in his heart that his client ought to have a verdict. If he does not believe it, his unbelief will appear to the jury despite all his protestations and will become their unbelief." Lillian Whiting caught the spirit and meaning of enthusiasm when she said, "No one has success until he has the abounding life. This is made up of the manifold activity of energy, enthusiasm, and gladness." It is to spring to meet the day with a thrill at being alive. It is to go forth to meet the morning in an ecstasy of joy. It is to realize the oneness of humanity in true spiritual sympathy. And it was enthusiasm that William Lloyd Garrison had in mind when he said, "I am aware that many object to the severity, enthusiasm, of my language, but is there not cause for severity? I will be as harsh as truth and as uncompromising as justice. On this subject, I do not wish to think or speak or write with moderation, without enthusiasm. No, no. Tell a man whose house is on fire to give a moderate alarm, an alarm without enthusiasm. Tell him to moderately rescue his wife from the hands of a ravisher. Tell the mother to gradually extricate her babe from the fire into which it has fallen, but urge me not to use moderation in a cause like the present. I am earnest, enthusiastic. I will not equivocate. I will not excuse. I will be heard." The apathy of the people is enough to make every statue leap from its pedestal and hasten the resurrection of the dead. Observe how those words of the great Garrison move one with feeling, although they were spoken many decades ago. The secret of their power is the enthusiasm with which they were spoken, for, as Mr. Carnegie has so impressively stated, the exact feeling in which words are expressed goes with them into the printed page, no matter if they are translated into other languages, no matter how many times they are reprinted. Philip James Bailey understood the power of enthusiasm when he said, "We live in deeds, not years, in thoughts, not breaths, in feelings, not in figures on a dial. We should count time by heart throbs. He most lives who thinks most, feels the noblest, acts the best." Yes, that is true, and one feels the noblest, acts the best, under the inspiration of enthusiasm, which helps us take inventory of the circumstances of life wherever we may, and then take action. Leigh Hunt understood the meaning of enthusiasm when he said, "There are two worlds, the world that we can measure with line and rule, and the world that we feel with our hearts and imagination." Fichte disclosed his deep understanding of the power of enthusiasm in these words, "My philosophy makes life, the system of feelings and desires, supreme, and leaves knowledge merely the post of observer. This system of feelings is a fact in our minds about which there can be no dispute, a fact of which we have intuitive knowledge, a knowledge not inferred by arguments, nor generated by reasonings which can be received or neglected as we choose. Only such face-to-face knowledge has reality. It alone can get life into motion, since it springs from life." Terence recognized the power of enthusiasm when he said, "You believe that easily which you hope for earnestly." James A. Garfield expressed his understanding of enthusiasm in these words, "If wrinkles must be written upon our brows, let them not be written upon the heart. The spirit should not grow old." He understood that the heart is the seat of enthusiasm, the source of emotional feeling. Tacitus said, "Adversity has no friends," and he spoke the truth, but he might well have said that adversity discourages friendships because it usually sours the emotions and dampens enthusiasm. Froebel revealed his deep understanding of the power of enthusiasm when he said, "The delusive idea that men merely toil and work for the sake of their bodies and procuring for themselves bread, houses, and clothes is degrading and not to be encouraged. The true origin of man's activities is his unceasing impulse to embody outside himself the divine and ritual element within him." Those who are informed in metaphysics know that material circumstances mean nothing, that material circumstances shape themselves to fit the state of one's mind as naturally as water flows downhill in response to the law of gravitation. The metaphysicist knows that the death of a dear friend or loved one need not bring sorrow, but it may serve as an inspiration to nobler efforts and deeper thinking through the principle of transmutation of emotional feeling. Emerson revealed his understanding of metaphysics in the following expressions of his thought. "A fever, a mutilation, a cruel disappointment, a loss of wealth, a loss of friends seems at the moment unpaid loss and unpayable, but the sure years reveal the deep remedial force that underlies all facts. The death of a dear friend, wife, brother, lover, which seemed nothing but privation, somewhat later assumes the aspect of a guide or genius. For it commonly operates revolutions in our way of life, terminates an epoch of infancy or youth which was waiting to be closed, breaks up a wanted occupation or a household or style of living, and allows the formation of new ones more friendly to the growth of character. It permits or constrains the formation of new acquaintances, and the reception of new influences that prove of the first importance to the next years. And the man or woman who would have remained a sunny garden flower, with no room for its roots and too much sunshine for its head, by the falling of the walls and the neglect of the gardener, is made the banyan of the forest, yielding shade and fruit to wide neighborhoods of men. One cannot get the full benefit of this chapter without recognizing the close relationship between positive and negative emotions, and the astounding possibilities of conversion of the negative into the positive. Once this possibility is understood, it will become clear that the confirmed pessimist may, by a change of his mental attitude, become a profound optimist, with the ability to express enthusiasm in exact proportion that he expressed pessimism. Mr. Carnegie has made frequent references to the desirability of one's taking possession of his own mind. We know some minds which are so negative that we would not recommend that their owners take possession of them, but we would recommend that they convert them from the negative to the positive, then take possession of them. The possession of a negative mind is a costly possession. Mr. Carnegie intended to have made this clear when he admonished people to take possession of their own minds. He had reference, of course, to the potentialities of a positive mind. Mary Baker Eddy described this same thought, in different terminology, when she said, "We know that a statement proved to be good must be correct. Now thoughts are constantly obtaining the floor. These two theories, that all is matter or that all is mind, will dispute the ground until one is acknowledged the victor." Discussing his campaign, General Grant said, "I propose to fight it out on this line, if it takes all summer. Science says, all is mind and mind's idea. You must fight it out on this line. Matter can afford you no aid. Harmony is produced by its principle, is controlled by it. Divine principle is the life of man. Man's happiness is not, therefore, at the disposal of physical sense. Truth is not contaminated by error. Harmony in man is as beautiful as in music, and discord as unnatural, unreal." If I interpreted Mrs. Eddy's thought accurately, she said, substantially, that the energy of thought is good or bad, negative or positive, only because of the use one makes of it, through one's mental attitude. There is but one kind of thought. It can be given many kinds of expression, either negative or positive. Reasoning on that simple premise, one can easily see that any negative emotion can be changed into a positive expression that may be helpful. In this possibility may one find the most profound application of enthusiasm. The same energy that brings the pain of sorrow may be converted and made to bring the joy of creative action in connection with one's definite major purpose or some minor purpose. Here is where self-discipline comes to one's aid. Only the disciplined mind can transmute sorrow into joy. The art of converting negative emotion into positive expression is acquired by the formation of habits designed to coordinate the action of the mind with the action of the body. In this respect, college athletes have much in their favor, for it is a well-known fact that an enthusiastic athlete may easily convert his enthusiasm from athletics to any sort of occupational endeavor he chooses. Tennis provides the very finest of media through which habits of coordination between the mind and body may be formed, and for this reason, if for no other, tennis should become the national game for all people, both the young and the older people. The man who has the bad habit of allowing his mind to use up energy in connection with worry will find tennis an excellent medium through which to convert his worries into enthusiastic courage. An hour on the tennis court, applied vigorously, will leave little room in one's mind for worry. Athletic training has another benefit. It develops the habit of clean sportsmanship as well as the habit of enthusiasm, and life calls for both of these qualities if one is to enjoy the greatest measure of success. Anything that creates temporary harmony in one's mind tends also to develop enthusiasm. The musician can exchange his worries for enthusiastic courage with the aid of his favorite musical instrument, and do it quickly. One famous author spends his rest time between working spells of about 1 hour each at his piano. Very often he does nothing but run the musical scales, but the coordination between his hands and his mind gives him rest and renews his energy. As Mr. Carnegie appropriately stated, this question of coordination between the mind and the body, through some form of vigorous action, is one of the surest and quickest ways of preparing the mind for enthusiasm. Dancing is another excellent form of exercise through which coordination between the mind and the body prepares the way for enthusiasm. I have heard an experienced teacher of dancing say that this form of exercise has been used successfully in treating patients suffering with mental disorders. The benefit comes, doubtlessly, because the rhythm of the dancing tends to clear the mind of complexes and fears, thus providing temporary expression of enthusiasm. This theory harmonizes perfectly with Mr. Carnegie's views. The author has trained himself over a long period of years to think on his typewriter. The moment he touches the keys, his mind begins to function with enthusiasm, his imagination becomes more alert, and ideas begin to flow in a steady stream. On many occasions, he has endeavored to think through a theme before beginning to express his thoughts in writing, only to discover that his thoughts were lacking in fluency. On some occasions, he has found it necessary to begin writing, perhaps on some subject foreign to that on which he was thinking, until his mind warmed up and enthusiasm began to appear. On other occasions, he has found it necessary to tear up the first 8 or 10 pages of his manuscript and rewrite it because he lacked enthusiasm at the beginning. This experience harmonizes perfectly with the experience of the public speaker who finds it difficult to express himself brilliantly until he warmed up his mind through the first 5 or 10 minutes of his speech. Athletes have similar experiences. That is why they go through the familiar warming-up process before beginning the game. They cannot play their best until there is sufficient coordination between the mind and the body to produce enthusiasm. The condition is entirely mental, not physical. Remember, therefore, that the first step one should take in transmuting negative thought into positive action is some form of physical action that is coordinated with one's thoughts. What enthusiasm is and what it does. Let me briefly describe the more important effects of enthusiasm. Mr. Carnegie has already presented an outline of the major destroyers of this essential quality of the mind. What, then, does enthusiasm do? 1. Enthusiasm steps up the vibrations of thought and thereby makes the faculty of the imagination more alert. 2. It clears the mind of negative emotions and thus paves the way for the development of faith. 3. It radiates confidence and sincerity. 4. It gives a pleasing color to the tone of the voice. 5. It helps to take the drudgery out of work. 6. It adds to the attractiveness of personality. 7. It inspires self-confidence. 8. It aids in the maintenance of sound health. 9. When accompanied by appropriate physical action, enthusiasm becomes of major importance as a medium for transmuting negative emotion into positive emotion. 10. It gives the necessary force to one's desires to influence the subconscious section of the mind to act upon them promptly. It is believed by some psychologists that the subconscious mind acts only on thoughts that are emotionalized, although the emotion may be either negative or positive. Other attributes of enthusiasm. Enthusiasm is the major factor which converts an order taker into a master salesman. It takes the dryness out of public speech by establishing harmony between the speaker and his audience. Thus, it is an indispensable quality in the work of anyone whose occupation depends, for its success, upon the spoken word. The enthusiastic speaker takes charge of his audience at will. It gives brilliancy to the spoken word, and there is considerable ground for the belief that it may enable a speaker to avail himself, directly, through the subconscious mind, of the power of infinite intelligence. There is no doubt that it gives one an alert memory. But, far and away, the two most important functions of enthusiasm are these. It definitely serves as the major factor in converting negative emotion into positive emotion, and it prepares the mind for the development of faith. Compared with these, all other functions of enthusiasm are inconsequential. As Mr. Carnegie has stated, enthusiasm is the result of motive. One cannot become enthusiastic without a cause. Enthusiasm, therefore, is an important factor in carrying out the object of one's definite major purpose. It is no less an asset, of course, in attaining one's minor purposes. Enthusiasm is the action factor of thought. Where it is strong enough, it literally forces one into physical action appropriate to the nature which inspired it. I believe, therefore, that Mr. Carnegie appropriately emphasized the importance of the relationship between enthusiasm and physical action. The development of enthusiasm without appropriate physical action is something like exploding a charge of dynamite in open air, where nothing happens except a loud noise. By moving promptly through some form of appropriate physical action when inspired by enthusiasm, one develops the habit of enthusiasm. A splendid way to begin this habit is by injecting enthusiasm into the spoken word. Here is a starting point within reach of everyone. It is one habit which requires no preparation to begin it. Start where you stand and begin now to train yourself to speak with enthusiasm, no matter to whom you are speaking or for what purpose. This habit will overcome timidity. It will inspire greater self-confidence. It will develop initiative. Train yourself not only to speak with enthusiasm, but to inject a pleasing tone into your voice. Loud talk without controlled tone may become nothing but offensive noise. Learn to dramatize words so they carry the exact meaning you intend them to carry. Nothing is more essential for success than effective speech. Speech is not effective if it is without color and enthusiasm. You will be surprised at the improvement you can make in your speech within a single week if you will make a studied effort to inject emotional feeling into every word you speak. Enunciate clearly. Speak each word separately. Do not run your words together by speaking some of them so inaudibly they can barely be heard. Speak out clearly and distinctly, and put force behind every word. One of the common evils of most people is careless speech. Remember that your manner of speech gives others a perfect clue as to the workings of your mind and the nature of your character. Here is one method by which you can acquire the habit of coordinating your thoughts with the physical action of speech. Within a month's time, you can so improve your manner of speech that you will hardly be recognized by your acquaintances when you speak. This habit will become one of the more beneficial media for the development of self-discipline. For obviously, there is no form of self-discipline that is more essential for success than discipline over one's spoken words. Most people talk too much, talk too carelessly, and say too little that is of advantage to them. Discipline over speech will overcome this fault. Thus, it will have served the double purpose of eliminating a fault and developing a virtue through a single effort. You can carry on your discipline over speech in all your conversations without anyone knowing that you are doing so. Begin with the members of your own family. Continue with your friends and acquaintances. Make it a part of your daily routine never to speak a single word that has not been studied and carefully modified before you speak it. Use words sparingly, as if they cost you $5 a word. Never speak just to hear the sound of your own voice or to impress others with your wisdom. Speak only to convey such thoughts as you wish others to receive from you. And be sure to put the exact feeling into your words that you wish the listener to interpret. There is enough sound advice in the preceding paragraph to make the difference between success and failure for many people. It is one of the tragedies of the age in which we live that the advice is one badly needed by a majority of the people. If it is true that talk is cheap, it may be true because the speaker himself is small. Remember this before you speak. Observe with benefit to yourself how sparingly successful men use words. They seldom engage in what is known as light conversations. Profanity is not on their vocabulary list. They spend no time in idle gossip. They do no slandering of other people. When they speak, they generally say something that is worth hearing. The man who has a steady flow of carelessly spoken words seldom has anything else. He is usually not among the successful. Time, to him, is something to be killed, but it is nothing more. He intrudes himself into conversations without either cause or invitation, and too frequently he will monopolize the conversation. If he has enthusiasm, it is wasted because his words will have no beneficial influence with anyone. I'm emphasizing the subject of speech because speech is the major means of expressing enthusiasm. Let us not foul this great outlet for enthusiasm with cheap talk that has no purpose. There is no place where definiteness of purpose is more appropriate than it is in connection with speech. Words that have no purpose might better have been left unspoken. The business of living, of mastering obstacles and attaining a modest degree of success, is a serious business. It requires all of one's time and effort. No one has even a minute he can afford to waste in idle talk or careless speech. It is no mere accident that only a few people succeed in making life pay on their own terms, while the vast majority go through life as failures. Analyze the use people make of their time, and you will observe the cause of both success and failure. Successful people work with definiteness of purpose and devote all their time, in a spirit of enthusiasm, to the attainment of that purpose. The failures devote their time to eating, sleeping, doing as little work as they can get by with, and purposeless talk. The difference in the ability of men is not the determining factor of their success or failure. It is the use they make of their ability that counts. One of the strange circumstances of many who fail is the fact that if they had gone one single step further, they might have succeeded instead. Every successful person I have analyzed acknowledged that he would have failed innumerable times if he had not kept on when overtaken by defeat. The person who is driven by an obsessional enthusiasm is not so apt to accept temporary defeat for failure. His will to win is greater than his willingness to quit. If enthusiasm did nothing else except sustain one in the times of defeat, it would justify all the time that is necessary to cultivate it. Enthusiasm is one quality that is indispensable to the man who has made up his mind to attain a high goal in life. It is the quality that helps him convert defeat into renewed effort. I had an interview with Thomas A. Edison which disclosed the great inventor's power of enthusiasm. It also provided a significant suggestion as to the value of the mastermind principle in the development of enthusiasm. Let us see what the great Edison had to say on this subject. "Mr. Edison," I began, "you have given the world the talking machine, the moving picture, incandescent electric light, and a score of other useful mechanical devices. And now I have come to ask you to give to the world the secret by which you mastered discouragement and temporary defeat while you were perfecting these conveniences." Edison made no reply. I turned red in the face and looked around to see if anyone could explain the inventor's silence, when Mr. Meadowcroft, Edison's secretary, broke in, saying, "I'm sorry I did not tell you, but Mr. Edison is deaf. You have to write your questions on a piece of paper." From there on, the interview moved smoothly. The question was repeated in writing, and Edison began by asking, "Where shall I begin?" "Begin with your early boyhood, if you do not mind," I replied, "and tell me about your schooling." "Oh, my schooling, eh? Well, I suppose you know that my teacher sent me home from school after I had been in school only 3 months, with a note saying I did not have enough sense to take a schooling, and there is where my book learning stopped. But I guess this turn of events was fortunate, because it saved me the time that I might have spent in useless study of abstract rules and forced me to begin school in the greatest of all educational institutions, the University of Hard Knocks." "You know that education comes from surmounting difficulties," the inventor continued, "and not from reading about them." I asked Edison to tell the story of how Edwin C. Barnes had managed to start as a clerk in the Edison offices and lift himself to the status of a business partner. Edison grinned broadly as he began the story. "Perhaps Ed Barnes should tell you about this himself, but I will give you a part of the story. One day I looked up from my work and saw a young man standing there with a suitcase in his hands. Meadowcroft said the young man had arrived on a freight train, and he looked as if he had. Then Ed took over the conversation by explaining that he had come a long way to go to work for me, and he said he would start anywhere. I put him to work, but he wanted me to know that sooner or later he was going to become a business partner of mine. I looked him over from head to foot, very carefully. I must have embarrassed him very much, because he spoke right up and said, 'You know, I do not have to work, Mr. Edison. I could starve to death if I wanted to.' This made a hit with me, because the lad's eyes flashed with the fire of enthusiasm that marked him as one who would never quit until he got what he went after. I gave him a job sweeping floors, and that is all I ever had a chance to give him, because he kept me busy receiving from him after that, until he finally gave himself a partnership with me, installing Ediphones.
When you talk to Barnes, ask him about his suits of clothes. He has 31 of them, you know, one for each day of the month. He said he needs them to stimulate enthusiasm. Those who believe jobs are hard to get and complain about not having pull enough to get a chance at the better positions will do well to remember how the only business partner Thomas A. Edison ever had found his chance. Certainly it was not by accepting difficulty as anything more than a stepping stone. Certainly it was not by doing as little work as he could get by with.